Usually when we talk about the great outdoors, it's all about the gear, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe conservation, but in a very abstract way.
Totally. It's the Instagram version of nature. You get
Yeah.
the mist rising off a lake, maybe the deer in a
Not
field.
exactly. It's romantic, scenic. But today I kind of want to look at the plumbing. We have these documents here, and they're basically the blueprints for the back office of the hunting industry. And honestly, it's a lot more bureaucratic and way more combative than I ever expected.
It really is. We're looking at a pretty specific case study today. It's a blog post, an announcement, really, from the American Hunting Lease Association, the AHLA.
Right, and this goes back to March 2016 from their Sportsman's Monthly
Yeah,
thing.
but before you tune out, because he said 2016, the date really doesn't matter.
No, not at all. It's about a mechanism. And what we're going to do in this deep dive is uncover how a niche hobby stays alive through this very calculated mix of insurance math and, well, political aggression.
Right. The whole mission here is to unpack a partnership. On one side, you got the AHLA, and they're basically selling safety insurance.
Okay.
And on the other side, you have the Sportsman's Alliance, and they sell advocacy. And this document we're looking at, it's basically the receipt for a transaction between them.
It's just such a fascinating intersection, isn't it? You don't usually see general liability and political warfare in the same thought.
Well, let alone the same business model.
But that's the hook. Access to nature isn't free, and it's definitely not accidental. It needs, what, a shield against lawsuits?
And a sword against regulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And today we're seeing exactly how those two tools get bought and paid for.
So let's start with that shield, the American Hunting Lease Association. If I just land on their website and we're just looking at the headers from the source material, what are they selling?
On the surface, it's a very specialized insurance marketplace. Their product list is super specific. You've got hunting lease
Sure,
insurance.
clubs and things.
Yeah. Guides and outfitters insurance. And then the one that always, always catches my eye. Vacant land insurance.
Vacant land insurance. I want to pause on that for a second because that phrase is doing so much work. Why do you need to insure nothing?
Because in the eyes of the law, nothing is a huge liability.
Yeah.
And that's the core problem the AHLA exists to solve.
Okay, break that down.
Imagine you own, say, a few hundred acres of woods. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
You might want to let people hunt on it and make a little extra cash from a lease fee.
Right. So I monetize the land, treat it like a rental property, but for a hunter.
Exactly. But the second you take money and let someone walk onto that property with a weapon, you are exposing yourself to, well, massive risk.
If they trip or fall out of a tree stand or something worse.
You, the landowner, are the one getting sued.
So that fear keeps the gate locked.
Precisely. And the source material explicitly says that the AHLA educates landowners on potential revenue. They aren't just selling a policy, they're pitching a business plan.
They're saying, hey, that empty land you have, it's an asset.
But you can't unlock that asset without our key. And the key is, of course, the insurance policy.
It turns a no trespassing sign into a revenue stream.
It's the only thing that makes it possible. They even have tools listed, like LeaseSpotter and Hunter Resources.
LeaseSpotter sounds like an app.
It functions like a marketplace. Think of it like Airbnb, but for the woods. But unlike renting a condo, renting a hunting spot has some pretty obvious dangers.
Right?
So the AHLA organizes that market and then provides the safety net. It makes a whole transaction feel safe.
It's wild. We think of hunting as this primal thing, but before anyone even steps in the woods, there's a contract, a premium paid, a risk assessment.
It's the infrastructure of access. And what's interesting is the AHLA seems to know that this infrastructure is fragile. They're not just sitting back and collecting checks.
Okay, so that's the business side, calm, calculated risk. But then we get to the second player in this document, the Sportsman's Alliance.
And the tone just shifts completely.
It's like whiplash. You go from vacant land and leasing to, well, we have this quote from Sean Fabrocchi, the COO of the AHLA. How does he describe his partner?
He calls them an aggressive organization.
Aggressive, that is. Not a word you usually see in a corporate press release, unless you're talking about like sales goals or something.
But he means it politically.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He says they are fighting on our behalf. He talks about protecting the rights to hunt, fish, and enjoy the outdoors.
But the really telling part is that he defines an opponent.
The enemy at the gates, yeah. He explicitly calls out the anti-hunting lobby. And he doesn't just dismiss them. He describes them as strong and well organized.
That framing is so important. This isn't like a hobby, say, knitting where everyone just kind of agrees it's fine.
Right.
For Brock, it's framing this as an active conflict. He's saying, we have a business and there are powerful people actively trying to shut our entire business down.
And that's the sword we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
The HLA protects the landowner from the hunter suing them. The Sportsman's Alliance protects the whole system from activists or the government banning the activity itself.
It creates this really clear division of labor. The suits handle the contracts.
And the fighters handle the politics. And for Brock, basically admits they can't do it themselves. He says, for that reason alone, we rely on the Sportsman's Alliance.
Rely. That's a strong word. It implies dependency.
It is. Which brings us to the actual news here. This isn't just moral support. It's a transaction. The AHLA renewed their Sportsman's Alliance Leaders Club partnership.
Leaders Club sounds very exclusive.
And it comes with a price tag. The source specifies a $10,000 contribution.
Okay, let's pause on that number. In the grand scheme of corporate lobbying, is 10 grand actually a lot? Or is this just kind of a token gesture?
It's a great question. I mean, if this were Google or Amazon, no. $10,000 is a rounding error.
Right, it's lunch.
It's lunch, exactly. But we have to look at the scale here. These are niche organizations. This is not Big Pharma. For an advocacy group like the Sportsman's Alliance, a $10,000 check from one partner is significant.
But it's more than just the money, right? It's a signal.
It's a huge signal. We have a quote here from Sean Curran. He's the VP at the Sportsman's Alliance. He thanks them for the renewed business partner support.
Business partner.
He doesn't say donor.
That's a big distinction.
It is. A donor gives to charity. A partner invests in a shared outcome. The AHLA is investing in the survival of its own market.
Because if that anti-hunting lobby wins...
If they win, and hunting is severely restricted, nobody needs to buy hunting lease insurance. Mm. The AHLA's main product becomes totally obsolete.
So that 10 grand is not charity. It's a survival tax.
That's a good way to put it. Curran even says that the threats affecting the entire hunting industry steadily increases.
Increases, present tense.
He's painting this picture of a rising tide.
Right.
And by writing that check, the AHLA is paying the alliance to go out and build a dam.
It's just a strategic use of profits to make sure there are future profits.
And they're so open about it. Usually this stuff is buried. But here, they're issuing a press release saying, hey, we gave the aggressive guys 10 grand to go fight for us.
And their customers must love that.
They have to. The hunters and landowners, they feel that pressure. So when they see their insurance company funding the fight, it builds massive brand loyalty. It says, we are in the trenches with you.
But it's not just a one-way street. It's not just money going out. The text mentions the AHLA gets something back beyond just, you know, protection.
Yes, and this is where you see how sophisticated the partnership really is. For Brooke from the AHLA says that over the last year, they've been represented by the alliance, but educated as well.
Educated as well. That stood out to me, too. What kind of education does an insurance company need from a lobbyist?
Well, think about what the lobbyists are doing. They're in the state capitals. They're monitoring bills.
They're gathering intel.
They're gathering intelligence. Exactly. The Sportsman's Alliance is on the front lines. They know which laws might be changing, which new regulations are being proposed, where public opinion is shifting.
Ah, okay. So they feed that intel back to the insurance company.
Right. And what does the AHLA do with that information? It helps them price risk, find new markets. It helps them educate landowners on potential revenue.
I see the loop now. It's surprisingly elegant.
It's a perfect feedback loop. Let's trace it.
Yeah, let's do it. Step one.
Step one. The AHLA finds a landowner and says, lease your land, we'll insure it.
Okay. Step two. The landowner makes money, the hunter gets access, and the AHLA collects premiums.
Step three. The AHLA takes a slice of those premiums, that $10,000, and gives it to the Sportsman's Alliance.
Step four. The alliance uses that money to fight laws that would restrict or ban hunting.
And the crucial step five. The alliance sends all that political intel back to the AHLA, which helps them refine their business.
And the whole cycle protects the business so it can start all over again.
It's a completely self-sustaining ecosystem. Commerce funds the cause, and the cause protects the commerce.
It really reframes what they mean by heritage. Sean Curran uses that exact phrase, protect and advance the outdoor heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at this document, heritage starts to look a lot like a modern financial product.
It is. The heritage is the brand, but the engine that keeps it running is finance and litigation. And the source makes it clear that this heritage is fragile. The urgency is everywhere.
Yeah, let's talk about that why, that feeling of urgency. Curran says the threats increase each year. It all feels very defensive.
It is. The tone isn't, hey, everything's great, go enjoy the woods. It's, we are under siege.
Which is what I find so fascinating. We're talking about an insurance company.
Right.
They're supposed to be the most boring, risk-averse businesses on the planet. They like spreadsheets, not activists.
But in this case, the insurance company seems to have realized it cannot be neutral. In this specific industry, staying neutral is a death sentence. If they don't pick a side in the culture war,
they lose their business.
They have to be partisan. Their entire existence depends on the political survival of hunting.
I noticed something else in the source, on their website sidebar. Under resources, they have blog, shop, and then how we give.
How we give?
Yeah. It suggests that this blend of commerce, the shop, and political support, that how we give, it's just baked right into their DNA. It's not a side project.
That's a great point. It signals to the customer that when you buy their insurance, you're not just a customer, you're joining the tribe, you're a supporter.
It turns paying your premium into a form of activism. Buy this policy, save your lifestyle.
Which is an incredibly powerful marketing tool. And it makes that $10,000 check feel like it came from the entire community, not just a corporate account.
So for you listening, this is really the key takeaway. When we look at these interest groups, we tend to think it's just about, I don't know, passion or tradition.
People yelling at town halls.
Right. But underneath all of that, there is a financial backbone. There are insurance premiums funding political aggression. There are liability contracts that make land access possible in the first place.
It's like the hunting industry built its own immune system.
Oh, I like that.
The insurance company generates the nutrients, the money, and the advocacy group acts like the white blood cells attacking the threats.
And this blog post is just a snapshot of that immune system in action. I want to circle back to one thing before we wrap, though. That idea of vacant land.
It keeps coming back to that, doesn't it?
It does, because now when I'm driving through the country and I see a stretch of woods with a fence around it, I used to just see nature, something wild. But now...
Now you see an asset class, a risk being managed by a contract, a revenue stream being defended by a lobbyist.
It makes you wonder how much truly wild space is even left.
Or maybe if wild space can even exist anymore without these structures. Does that forest stay a forest if it can't generate revenue? Or does it just get sold to a developer?
That's the really uncomfortable question, isn't it? Maybe the only reason those trees are still standing is because someone, somewhere, bought a vacant land insurance policy on them.
And because an aggressive organization fought a political battle to keep that whole transaction legal.
It's a complex web. The infrastructure of the outdoors is so much more industrial than just, you know, putting on a pair of boots and walking outside.
It certainly is. It's a managed experience from top to bottom.
Well, that is definitely something to think about next time you see a no trespassing sign. It's not just a sign. It's a whole business strategy.
Always a pleasure to connect these dots.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll catch you on the next one.
Take care.